good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Bly Street. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director of the Institute, and it's my pleasure to be hosting the Foreign Minister today. Let me say at the beginning, it's good to see so many friends of the Institute in the audience. In particular, I'd like to acknowledge Jim Spiegelman, Chairman of the ABC, and more importantly for me, one of my board members. Also Mark Ryan, also of the Institute's board. Bruce Gosper, CEO of Austrade, one of our government members and representatives of other members, several ambassadors and consuls general, and also Peter Grester. Peter, I know that everyone in the room is delighted to have you amongst us today, especially today. Ladies and gentlemen, we're honoured to be welcoming Julie Bishop back to Bly Street, and I'll introduce her in a moment after I've just said one or two things. When the federal government brought down its budget a few weeks ago, there was a lot of coverage of the reduction in Australia's foreign aid program. But the government also announced another measure with significant implications for the conduct of Australia's foreign affairs. The government committed a substantial amount of money to open five new overseas missions in a major expansion of Australia's overseas diplomatic network. And four of these five will be in Australia's immediate neighbourhood here in Asia. A lot of us here at Bly Street were very encouraged by this announcement. The Institute has led the debate on Australia's diplomatic footprint for the better part of a decade, in particular through the work of my colleague Alex Oliver. Now more than ever, we need a first-rate foreign service. Our economy relies on trade and foreign investment. Our region is changing before our eyes, and the demands for consular assistance are multiplying. All this requires energetic and creative diplomacy and diplomats in country. For years, the Institute's argument that Australia needs a larger and better resourced foreign service have met with vigorous and bipartisan nodding. But this is the largest increase in our diplomatic footprint in many years, and I'd like to congratulate the Foreign Minister for achieving this in a difficult budgetary environment. Ladies and gentlemen, Julie Bishop was sworn in as Australia's 38th Minister for Foreign Affairs on the 13th of September 2013, after 4.5 years as the Shadow Minister. She's also the Deputy Leader of the Liberal Party and has served as the Member for Curtin in the House of Representatives since 1998. Previously, she served in a number of ministerial roles in the Howard government. She's a friend of the Institute and has spoken at Bly Street on many occasions. This is actually her second major address of the day. She joins us from the CVE summit down at Pier 1, where she's already given an important speech. So thank you very much, Julie, for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the Foreign Minister.
Good afternoon to this most distinguished audience. I'm absolutely delighted to be back at Lowy Institute. Over the years, Australia has been described as a middle power. I don't believe that adequately reflects our standing or our level of influence. While we should be careful not to overstate it, neither should we understate it. Australia is a top 20 country in almost every relevant economic and social measure, other than population, where we come in at 56th. We have the 12th highest GDP in the world, the 5th highest GDP per capita. Australia's pool of investment funds under management is the largest in Asia, the 3rd largest in the world at $2.6 trillion. Australia is the world's number one global exporter of coal, iron ore, aluminium and beef. We're currently the 3rd largest exporter of LNG, although on track to become the world's largest exporter by 2020. We're the 4th most attractive destination for international students, the 5th in tourism. Importantly, we're the lifestyle capital of the world, with 4 Australian cities consistently ranked amongst the top 10 livable cities across the globe. We're a smart, creative and tolerant people with a robust economy and strong institutions. Our society, built on waves of immigration over the course of our history, possesses the energy and entrepreneurial spirit that comes from the meeting of cultures and ideas from all corners of the world. We are an open, liberal democracy committed to freedoms, the rule of law, human rights and democratic institutions. We are an open, export-oriented market economy. These two pillars are fundamental to our peace and prosperity as a nation. It's who we are. And in turn, both depend on our ability to engage with other nations and build relationships, alliances, security partnerships, trading ties. This means using our power, our hard power, our soft power, our assets that enable us to stand up for and defend where necessary our values and beliefs as a nation, and at all times promoting our national interests. Australia relies on alliances and agreements with other nations for leverage in exercising our hard power, the use of force, such as our military action in Afghanistan. For over 13 years, we have deployed defence personnel in coalition with others in a fight against extremists and terrorists to prevent another September 11, to ensure Afghanistan does not again become a haven for terrorists. Our military assets have also been used to support other nations achieve their security aims while looking out for our national interest. For example, currently in Iraq, over 400 of our defence personnel are training, advising and assisting the Iraqi government build the capacity of Iraqi security forces so that it can take back the territory that has been claimed by the brutal terrorist organisation known as Daesh and protect Iraqi citizens from the violent and barbaric actions of this terrorist group. In this way, we are working to prevent Daesh from attracting Australian foreign terrorist fighters and supporters to its ideology, thus seeking to keep Australians safe from terrorism. Soft power, on the other hand, has been described by renowned US academic and former dean of Harvard Kennedy School of Government, Joseph Nye, as getting others to want the outcomes you want, co-opting people rather than coercing them. Nye believes that soft power rests on the ability to shape the preferences of others and that a country may obtain the outcomes it wants in world politics because other countries, admiring its values, emulating its example, aspiring to its level of prosperity and openness, want to follow it. It is our foundation as a liberal democracy with respect for the rule of law, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and freedom of political affiliation, which greatly strengthens our voice internationally. Soft power can and does take many forms and can have a range of motivations overlapping from pursuing economic interests to meeting our obligations as a responsible member of the international community. And of course, our hard power assets can complement the exercise of our soft power. When Cyclone Pam hit Vanuatu in March this year, the island nation was devastated. 16 people were killed. Homes, schools, agricultural crops and government buildings were destroyed. Cyclone Pam raged over a Friday night and a Saturday, making access to the islands and Port Vila Airport in particular impossible. However, on the Sunday, Australia dispatched military transport planes, C-17s, C-130s, Black Hawk helicopters, together with life-saving supplies and equipment. HMAS Tobruk was dispatched with heavier equipment and more supplies on board. About 500 Australian Defence personnel took part in the humanitarian and disaster relief effort. Shortly after I visited Vanuatu, and many people told me that they'd lost everything and they were in despair about their future. However, when they saw the big grey Australian military planes overhead, they wept with relief. The Australians were coming. As a neighbour and a responsible regional player, Australia comes to the aid of our Pacific friends in times of need as a matter of course. However, we should not underestimate the impact of our influence as the largest and most developed nation in our region and the responsibility that we shoulder as a consequence of being that nation in the Pacific. And that was really brought home to me in Vanuatu. Now, this brings me to another vital aspect of our soft power, and that is our foreign aid program. As Michael indicated, in this year's budget, the extent of the government's fiscal deterioration over the previous 6 years was laid bare. We had inherited an unprecedented level of debt and record budget deficits, and as responsible fiscal managers, the Coalition is charting a credible course back to surplus. But this means that many areas of government expenditure have been hit, including the foreign aid budget. The required reduction in the forward estimates for the aid budget provided me with the opportunity to reassess our aid priorities. Where, how, why, what outcomes? Our 2015-2016 aid allocations were determined by a rigorous analysis into the contribution that Australia's aid makes to partner country GDP, to global overseas development assistance flows, and is based on economic growth forecasts. And I believe this is the first time this analysis has been applied to our aid program. Based on the evidence we gathered, Australia's aid allocations will focus mainly on the particular development challenges facing our neighbours in the Pacific. It's our neighbourhood, it's where we can make the biggest difference. So Australia will continue to invest significant funds in Pacific Island countries. Our humanitarian and emergency relief funds will allow Australia to respond to development and humanitarian challenges, such as Cyclone Pam in Vanuatu. Our program acknowledges the particular development challenges facing Pacific Island countries, such as the limited capacity of the public sector to provide basic services, the limited capacity of the private sector, and the geographic isolation from international markets. We have a particular responsibility to promote stability and prosperity for the nations of the Pacific, and our aid program in the Pacific aims to reduce poverty and increase standards of living by promoting and driving sustainable economic growth. Stronger economic growth in the Pacific, as that is the most powerful driver for lifting people out of poverty. And this has been proven in Asia, where nations recording strong economic growth have seen hundreds of millions of people lifted out of poverty. China and South Korea, for example, once aid recipients, are now major economies and major aid donors. This transformation from aid recipient nation to economic partner is the aim of the fast-growing economies of Southeast Asia. For example, in 2003, Thailand requested Australia no longer provide aid. Instead, we signed a free trade agreement, and bilateral trade has doubled to over $18 billion per year, dwarfing any aid program we could possibly have envisaged. These countries want trade, not aid. In 2003, Australian aid to Indonesia was 8% of our aid budget. It grew to 13% of our aid budget as a result of the tsunami in 2004. Under this budget, it will now be normalised back to 9%. And since 2004, Indonesia's economy has grown by around 6% per year. GDP has increased by about 70%. Indonesia is the 16th largest economy in the world, is a member of the G20, and is on track to becoming one of the top 10 economies in the world. So these examples demonstrate why we've reduced our foreign aid in some countries in recognition of their growth trajectory, the percentage that Australian aid makes to their economies and to their total aid. For example, Australian aid as a percentage of Indonesia's GDP is 0.1%, but in the case of Tuvalu, it's closer to 25%. Australia's assistance to growing Asian economies will focus on building economic partnerships and leveraging domestic capacity and resources to strengthen the private sector and improve development outcomes. Another example is Africa. Evidence shows that our total aid to Africa before this budget made up less than 0.7% of total ODA flows. And it is a fact that Europe, the United States, have primary responsibility for development outcomes in Africa, just as Australia has primary responsibility for development outcomes in the Pacific. I'm also becoming increasingly aware of the significant discrepancy in the way nations report on their aid and assistance to other countries. For example, Australia committed $50 million in humanitarian disaster relief and reconstruction funding to Vanuatu after Cyclone Pam. Yet this doesn't take into account the cost of our military deployment, which our Defence Department have estimated will be in the order of about $28 million. So our total assistance package is significantly larger than the sheer dollar amount through our aid program. Another example was our response to the Philippines Typhoon Haiyan in 2013, where while Australia committed $40 million in funds, we were not initially ranked as amongst the top donors. And I was puzzled by this. But it was when I analysed the rankings that I discovered that countries that deployed only assistance via their military assets had counted that cost. Fair enough. Australia also deployed a significant amount of military hardware in the form of planes and ships, yet we didn't take it into consideration. I've thus tasked the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade to develop a reporting platform that includes all support from Australia so that the full extent of our work and our assistance is understood. The United States refers to this comprehensive reporting of its overall assistance for each country as its Green Book. I believe it's vital, in foreign policy terms, that Australia receives appropriate credit for our support to other nations and that the true extent of our contribution is understood at home and abroad. I intend that the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade produce a Green Book with input from other departments and agencies so that a comprehensive picture of Australia's support can be presented to the world. We live in interesting and ever-changing times. Doing what we've always done in foreign policy will not meet all the new and emerging challenges. That's why I'm seeking to drive institutional change through our diplomatic service and through our international engagement. Technology is changing the world, and it's important that the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade embraces this change and harnesses it to the greater advantage of our nation and to the promotion of our values and our interests abroad. We are a nation of innovators, and I'm seeking to embrace innovation within our foreign policy, beginning with our aid program. Recently, I launched what I call the Innovation Exchange, a separate entity within the department, housed within separate premises. It's over the road from DFAT, a bright, breezy, collaborative and creative environment. So think Google and Facebook rather than RG Casey. The Innovation Exchange has been charged with finding and delivering innovative solutions to some of our region's aid and more intractable development challenges. The people selected to work in the Innovation Exchange are creative thinkers with flair and problem-solving ability. Their work is guided by an international reference group comprising Michael Bloomberg, entrepreneur, philanthropist, UN Cities and Climate Change Envoy, who served as Mayor of New York for 11 years. Sally Osborg, President and CEO of the Skoll Foundation, author, global thought leader. Chris Vane, former Chief Innovation Officer for Global Technology Development at the World Bank and now on secondment to our Innovation Exchange. Bjorn Lomborg, named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World and Director of the Copenhagen Consensus Centre. Sarah Pearson, CEO of the newly formed CBR Innovation Network and a globally recognised practitioner and advocate of innovation. Veronica Lukito, founder and CEO of Berkeley Investment Asia in Jakarta, an investment firm focused on venture capital and renewable energy investment. Sam Mostyn, our very own, president of the Australian Council for International Development. Ryan Stokes, Chief Executive Officer of Seven Group Holdings, Chairman of the National Library of Australia. Tara Nathan, Executive Director for International Development at MasterCard in the United States. Andrew Motu, Director of Papua New Guinea's National Museum and Art Gallery. He has a doctorate in social anthropology from Cambridge. Sanjay Reddy, Vice Chairman of GVK, an Indian conglomerate with extensive business interests, including GVK Biosciences, one of Asia's largest contract research organisations employing more than 2,000 scientists. Annie Parker, co-founder of the Muru D Telstra, which invests in and nurtures early-stage startups with the objective of growing the digital economy in Australia. Dr. Sam Prince, owner of Zambrero restaurant chain and founder of One Disease, a not-for-profit organisation that aims to eliminate significant diseases affecting Australians today. We had our first meeting of the International Reference Group. They Skyped and phoned and appeared from all over the world, and it was one of the most stimulating sessions I have participated in as we came up with ideas and problems that required solutions. And this combination of private sector, public sector, NGO experience was utterly stimulating. And we need bold and lateral thinkers who challenge and in turn are challenged by the problems presented to them. Importantly, I'm encouraging the contest of ideas within the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And I hope this takes off across the private sector, where the best ideas are adopted and scaled up and the weakest are discarded. The establishment of our Innovation Exchange recognises the changing nature of international development, with private capital flows and remittances dwarfing traditional aid funding. One of our first projects, the Seed Pacific Initiative, will broker and support the most promising partnerships between global businesses and local organisations to solve development challenges in Pacific Island countries. It will incubate and then scale up business models that have commercial viability and development impact. And I'm also taking innovative steps in seeking the tenders for this initiative, turning the usual practice in government tendering on its head. Instead of excruciatingly detailed guidelines into what government believes must be done, an approach that generally receives less than 10 expressions of interest in any one aid project, we have simply stated the problem, the money available, and asked the prospective tenderers to tell us, tell the government what we should do to achieve the desired outcome. This has resulted in over 60 expressions of interest. As well as broadening the policy-making process to bring in new participants, we're making it easier for good ideas to flow upwards. Managing the challenges ahead will require creative thinking and willingness to engage with risk. And that is a novel concept within government. We need to encourage those within our department who have the good ideas to come forward. And to this end, I've established the Ideas Challenge within the department. It was an online competition where Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade staff were encouraged to offer their ideas to improve the effectiveness of our aid program and the department's performance overall. This has unleashed a wealth of ideas. We narrowed it down to 400, and in Eurovision style, we opened these ideas up to a vote, and 20,000 votes were cast from our diplomats and employees across the globe. Next Monday in Canberra, we'll choose the winning ideas for immediate implementation. Some were so good that Secretary Varghese has already implemented changes to the way the department does business. Ladies and gentlemen, when I took on the role as Australia's Foreign Minister in September 2013, I will admit that the words of two important Lowy Institute research papers were ringing in my ears. The 2009 paper, Australia's Diplomatic Deficit, found that, and I quote, "Australia has fewer diplomatic missions than all but a few OECD countries, leaving us badly underrepresented, particularly in emerging centres of power of significance to our interests." This was followed by another in 2011, Diplomatic Disrepair, which found that Australia, quote, "has the smallest diplomatic network of all G20 nations and only 9 of the 34 OECD countries, all far smaller than Australia, have fewer diplomatic missions. Most of them enjoy more stable geopolitical surrounds and or can rely on the added diplomatic weight derived from membership of a regional bloc such as the European Union." I took these words on board and requested the department to undertake a review of our diplomatic footprint immediately after our election in 2013. 10 new posts were identified as priorities, although an expansion of this size in one announcement would have posed enormous logistical challenges for us and tested the patience of the Expenditure Review Committee. While not claiming to have redressed all the issues identified by the Lowy reports, I was pleased to announce on Budget Night the single largest expansion of Australia's diplomatic network in over 40 years. This involved nearly $100 million to open 5 new overseas missions in consultation with host governments: Qatar, Mongolia, Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, and Thailand. You may have noticed that four of the five nations have warmly welcomed our proposal for an increased presence, and I will continue to engage constructively with Papua New Guinea to reach mutual agreement on the best way forward. These proposed additional posts will provide an expanded platform to build on the work of our existing diplomatic network, our consular network, and provide us with the opportunity to promote another of our soft power policies encapsulated by the phrase economic diplomacy. One of my first acts as Foreign Minister was to ask each of our embassies, high commissions and consulates to develop business plans to be implemented over the short, medium and longer term, with a view to increasing the economic ties and the trade and investment opportunities between the host country and Australia. These business plans were to include achievable goals and benchmarks. Now, this should not have been a remarkable request. However, our ambassadors, high commissioners and consul generals had never previously been asked to develop such plans. Austrade, of course, is our agency that does this as their mandate. But we have such an incredible network of diplomats who meet with businesses, governments, industry, and have extraordinary networks that were not being tapped to their fullest potential. And I was delighted by the enthusiastic response to my request and greatly impressed by the quality of the business plans that were submitted to DFAT headquarters in Canberra and shared with my office. These plans encompass a wide variety of issues, including the promotion of trade and investment opportunities to Australian companies and individuals, working to strengthen the private sector in developing countries, promoting Australia as an attractive destination for tourism, education, business and much more. The plans included about 2,000 initiatives that could have been implemented immediately or at least in the short term. We have, of course, continued to use traditional methods of diplomacy to achieve outcomes in our national interest. For example, our diplomatic efforts in the United Nations Security Council last July, when we sought international support for a ceasefire in eastern Ukraine to enable independent investigators and experts access to the crash site of Malaysian Airlines MH17. In record time, Australia authored a draft resolution, circulated the draft, negotiated the terms and obtained support so that a unanimous resolution could be passed by the Security Council on the 21st of July 2014, within 4 days of that horrific tragedy. And it demonstrated to me that we have some of the most accomplished diplomats in the world. At the other end of that soft power diplomacy scale is our Koala Diplomacy Initiative. In recognition of the 50th anniversary of Singapore's independence and 50 years of diplomatic relations between Australia and Singapore, we arranged for the loan of 4 koalas to Singapore Zoo as a further expression of our friendship. Qantas generously supported the initiative and transported the koalas from Brisbane's Lone Pine Sanctuary free of charge and will fly loads of fresh eucalyptus leaves weekly during the loan period of up to 10 months. Their transport and the photo opportunity of them sitting in Qantas business first class and their arrival in Singapore generated an extraordinary amount of media coverage. Predictably, the 4 furry ambassadors, the stars of the show, have captured the hearts and minds of the Singapore public. But the arrival of the koalas in Singapore had almost 200 media outlets cover the story in print and online, reaching millions of people in Singapore and around the world. Channel News Asia ran a 16-minute feature. BBC World News ran a 4-minute story throughout the day to its global audience and an online story with over 600,000 visits to that webpage. The Straits Times, Singapore's major newspaper, had a front-page colour photo of the koalas, and there's been extensive coverage across Europe, Canada, the United States, with the koalas even making the New York Times. The estimated advertising value from global coverage of the koalas to date is around $4 million and escalating. The benefits to our nation will be exponentially greater in terms of increased tourism and through the generation of enormous goodwill towards our country. Our koalas have come to represent our warmth, our openness, our friendship as a nation. Any speech that I give on soft power diplomacy must also include a reference to one of our signature foreign policy programs, the New Colombo Plan. This is an overseas study program to provide Australian undergraduates with the opportunity to live, study and work, undertake internships and work experience and practicums in our region. 38 nations have joined the New Colombo Plan, and within 3 years of its establishment, that is by the end of 2016, nearly 10,000 Australian students will have undertaken this experience to make them more Asia literate, to better understand our place in the world and our relationships within our region, as well as giving them new perspectives, new insights, new skills, new ideas that will build our productivity and our prosperity. But over time, there will be an alumni of young ambassadors with a deeper understanding of our region, amongst whom will be the future community, business and political leaders of our country. The friendships, the networks and connections that they make will endure and hopefully last a lifetime. Just as the original Colombo Plan generated generations of goodwill towards our country as young people from the region studied in Australian institutions, so too will the new Colombo Plan be an investment not only in our young people, but in our region and an investment in Australia's future. Soft power diplomacy at its best. As Joseph Nye observed, soft power is about getting others to buy into our values. I, of course, believe that a world where our values were universally embraced would be a safer and more peaceful world. But when engaging with other nations, I don't presume to lecture them about what I believe is right or wrong about their laws, governments, values, or societies. I can, however, offer them the benefit of our experience, of our successful society that has welcomed people from every corner of the world to create arguably the most diverse and multicultural nation on earth. We are a society that thrives on opportunity and reward for effort, with few barriers to those willing to work hard and achieve a higher standard of living. Australia is without doubt one of the world's significant nations, and therein lies our diplomatic strength that I have sought to use to further our national interest, to influence others, and to build prosperity and peace in our region and beyond. Thank you.
For those very detailed, wide-ranging remarks. It took us from high politics in New York to koala diplomacy. I think they'll be studied very closely in coming days and weeks. The Minister has agreed to take questions for about 25 minutes or half an hour. There's no Eurovision-style voting. You'll be pleased to hear, Minister. So I'm happy to take questions. Can I ask you to raise your hand to get my attention? Can I ask you to pose a question rather than making a statement. Keep it brief. I recommend that you don't try to catch the Minister out on her knowledge of the movie Frozen, by the way, because the last time that happened, it didn't end well for the person in question. So can I ask you to raise your question if you'd like to ask a question to the Minister? Yes, sir.
Pavel Vanishkin, the Russian news agency TASS. Can I ask a question about the current relations between Australia and Russia? As far as I understand, they are not particularly excellent, to put it mildly. Does Australia government currently have any plans, intentions, maybe specific initiatives to improve it?
Relations between Australia and Russia are currently overshadowed by Russia's actions in Ukraine and Crimea. And earlier last year, we joined with other like-minded nations in taking a stand against what we saw as a breach of Ukraine's sovereignty. And we joined with other nations in imposing sanctions on Russia for its behaviour, which we believed breached international norms. Subsequently, the tragedy of MH17 has also strained relations because, of course, we believe that the separatists that were preventing our access to the site to retrieve the remains of the Australians who were killed in that tragedy were being denied access because they were backed by Russia, and we appealed directly to Russia to allow investigators and experts onto the site so that we could remove the remains. President Putin came to the G20 meeting and he engaged in discussions bilaterally and through the G20 process. But the sanctions remain, the autonomous sanctions from Australia and those of other nations remain on Russia, while ever its actions towards Ukraine's sovereignty remain as they are.
Minister, while I'm waiting for people to collect their thoughts, can I ask you a question on a topic that perhaps you addressed in at the CVE summit, and that is the proposal to strip Australian citizenship from Australians who are dual citizens and who are found guilty of terrorist offences. Peter Grester spoke at the Institute yesterday and he made the point that as a dual citizen with a terror conviction to his name, he could theoretically lose his Australian citizenship under these proposals. Now, obviously, it wouldn't happen in his case, but he made the point that his case illuminates some of the problems to do with the ministerial discretion and the rule of law. Why shouldn't we be concerned about those proposals?
Well, we have put out a discussion paper on the rights and obligations of citizenship, and I think this is the right place to begin. What does it mean to hold Australian citizenship, and what are the current constraints and rights and obligations imposed by law and precedent? And Australian citizenship can be denied or can be stripped of someone who is deemed to be fighting against Australia in a conflict, and that was inserted into the citizenship after the Second World War. And you can understand the scenario where an Australian was fighting for a country that was at war with Australia. What we're dealing with now are non-state actors who have essentially declared war on Australia. ISIL or Daesh, this terrorist organisation, is encouraging its followers, its foreign terrorist fighters, to take up arms, to carry out attacks on individuals around the world, nations around the world, and they specifically mention Australia. And tragically, we have, luckily but tragically, we've had to thwart about 7 terrorist attacks since September last year here in Australia. This is a very serious issue, taking away citizenship, in circumstances where someone is acting against the interests of Australia. But other countries have embraced this notion, the United Kingdom specifically. Others are looking at it, Canada, the United States, and European countries, particularly ones I've visited recently, are all considering what they can do about those who are abusing the citizenship that's been granted to them. And if they have dual citizenship, is it possible to take away one, leaving them with their citizenship, their other citizenship? Of course, we are a party to many treaties that relate to the issue of statelessness, one in particular. And unlike Great Britain, we don't have a reservation to that treaty. The UK did. So it's a matter that we're considering in depth. As to Peter's point about ministerial discretion, I already have the discretion to cancel passports, to refuse to issue them or to suspend them, where I'm advised by our security agencies that the person poses a national security risk, either here in Australia or are intending to join a terrorist organisation overseas. So I exercise that only on the specific advice and recommendation of our intelligence agencies. And I'm finding that recently there's more focus in the media about the passports I haven't cancelled than the ones that I have. So it is a question of balance, and it will be a challenge for us, but I don't believe that we've ever faced such a pernicious, global, sophisticated and dangerous terrorist organisation as that which is currently existing in Syria, Iraq, but its tentacles are expanding dramatically. Indeed, I was in Paris at the small group meeting of coalition countries supporting the Iraqi government in building the capacity of its security forces so that it can defeat Daesh in their country. And it was noted that about 90 countries around the world can claim to have citizens fighting as terrorists in Iraq and Syria. So no country is immune, and I don't believe that we'll be the only country, certainly not the first and certainly not the last, to consider this question of citizenship.
Thank you. John Spender, if you could just wait for the microphone, former Ambassador John Spender.
Minister, if you leave Singapore and you take a sort of a general left turn, you'll come to the China Seas, as you know. And we have the on-running dispute over the Spratly Islands and the building by China of infrastructures which would seem to be only possible to be built for the purposes of power rather than anything else. This is leading to an on-running dispute between China and the United States and others. What can you tell us about how you can go about helping to resolve that issue, how we as a country can, and what policies we should embrace and what policies we should avoid?
The territorial claims over the South China Seas are many and complex. China is not the only nation claiming territorial rights over the South China Seas. Indeed, there are some 8 countries that have claims in one form or another. Australia has not taken a position on the rights or wrongs of the respective claims. We believe that they should be resolved through peaceful negotiation or through a reference to international arbitration, as the Philippines have done in the case of what they call the West Philippine Sea, through UNCLOS. However, we are concerned that unilateral action by any one of the claimants will raise tensions, could risk miscalculation or misjudgment, and could ultimately end in some form of conflict. It's therefore essential that all nations who have an interest in free navigation through the South China Seas, through free air navigation over the South China Seas, who depend upon that freedom for their national interests, in our case, our trade and investment and our economic interests, as well as our strategic, should make their views known to China through bilateral representations, through forums such as the East Asia Summit, and by working with the ASEAN countries who are seeking to establish a code of conduct in relation to the South China Seas. And some progress was made last year on the code of conduct, but it seems to have stalled in recent times. The evidence of the reclamation work is undoubted. These islands are some 1,200 kilometres away from China, and so its aspirations are not entirely clear. But it is a matter that we discuss with others in the region. It is a matter that we discuss with China and will continue to raise with China. I believe that the United States and China have a very good understanding of how catastrophic it would be for there to be a conflict that engaged those two powerful nations. So our hope and our aim is to convince all nations involved in the South China Sea territorial disputes to resolve their differences peacefully, to adhere to international norms and the international rules-based system, and appeal to China as an important and increasingly significant power in our region to adopt the international norms that one would expect of a nation with such power and responsibilities.
I might ask a follow-up question on that, Minister. In a couple of weeks, the Institute will host the second UK-Australia 1.5-track Asia dialogue that came out of Auckland a couple of years ago. And I remember one of the issues we discussed with the Brits last year was we asked them, really, why were the Europeans so slow in putting out a clear statement when China declared an ADES? And it does seem to me that sometimes the European countries are guilty of looking at China purely as a market rather than as a strategic actor. Do you think that I mean, you talked about the role that regional actors have to play in establishing norms in China's near seas, but what about the role of extra-regional powers too, such as the European Union?
I believe that's exceedingly important, and our dialogue would include countries beyond the region, beyond the United States, because, of course, we all have an interest in freedom of navigation and freedom of the seas and freedom of the skies. And I think that some of the stances that we've taken against Russia, for example, given that that point was raised, about standing up for our values, our beliefs, the international rules-based order, must apply equally. And we did state our objection to China's unilateral announcement of an air defence identification zone over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands, and there was a response from China. But we were right to raise our point at that time, and we would do so again should there be any attempt by China or any other country to unilaterally declare an ADIZ over the South China Sea. But because of China's economic weight, and it is the largest trading partner of about 120 countries now worldwide, when China responds, it can have a significant economic and diplomatic impact. I recall that in recent years, the United Kingdom had incurred China's displeasure over the Prime Minister meeting the Dalai Lama, and my friends in Britain told me that they were in the freezer, a diplomatic term, for a number of years as a result of that. So the consequences can warn some off. But as I've stated in my speech today, Australia must be prepared to stand up for who we are, what our values and beliefs are, and countries in our region look to Australia to do that, none more so than in the instance of the South China Sea.
Thank you. The next hand I saw was from the lady in the front row.
Thank you. Susan Pond, sorry, from the US Studies Centre. I wanted to ask you to share your thoughts on another complex problem that I'm sure keeps you awake at night. You've already mentioned the typhoons in the Pacific Islands, Australia being a big coal exporter, both of which have touch points for global warming. So I was wondering if you could share with us your thoughts about your approach to the negotiations in Paris in December at the end of the year, when we're going to be talking about the possibility of setting beyond 2020 targets, which may or may not be binding.
Well, first, I am pleased that Australia will meet its 2020 targets. We will be one of a few countries, not all by any means, that will meet both their Kyoto targets. And so Australia will be in a position of being able to say we achieve what we say we'll achieve. Not all countries will be in that position. So we're taking our negotiating position very seriously in the lead up to COP21 in Paris at the end of the year. There is a whole of government review undertaken by the Prime Minister and Cabinet Department, and we have been consulting widely on the approach that we should take. In fact, we've held public consultations. Minister Greg Hunt and I have taken part in a number of public consultations on this, inviting business, industry, NGOs, anyone with an interest in climate change and our targets to come along and talk to us about what they believe that we should do. And we are in the process of refining what will be our targets. We said we would announce them in the middle of 2015, and I believe that that's what we will do in plenty of time before COP21. We will play a proportionate role, an appropriate role, a responsible role in ensuring that there is international buy-in in reducing global greenhouse emissions, that countries set realistic targets and adhere to them and achieve them, as Australia does and will, I believe. We are aware of the approach taken by other nations. It's a little complicated because not everybody uses the same benchmarks. The goalposts are different. But nevertheless, taking that into account, we've noted what Japan has done, what the European Union has done, what the United States, Canada and others are doing. So we've looked at what like-minded countries, what our competitors are doing, and we will play a responsible and proportionate role. So it won't be long before our targets are announced and the approach that we will take. In the meantime, our direct action plan and the credit auction has been beyond our expectations in terms of reducing Australia's contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. We're also assisting other nations in their attempts to reduce emissions. For example, we have signed a civilian nuclear supply agreement for the supply of uranium to India, because India, a developing but significant country and economy, still has millions and millions of people without access to electricity. And so we're doing our part in providing the necessary resources that India seeks, in this case uranium, so that it can establish the low or zero emissions technologies that come with nuclear power.
I think I saw Jenny Hayward-Jones' hand at the back.
Good afternoon, Minister. You mentioned you're interested in the promotion of a green book to more accurately reflect Australia's assistance to developing countries. Given the rise in new approaches to development and different ways of delivering development assistance, do you think this is an initiative that could be promoted worldwide as a new way of measuring and comparing the way countries deliver assistance?
I've most certainly been very interested in what is considered overseas development assistance in the OECD world. And sometimes it's rather grey as to what should be ODA-able, as they say, and what is not. I'm hoping that the Green Book just makes it far more transparent and far more obvious as to what we do in supporting countries. An example is Africa. People were saying you've reduced the aid budget in Africa, but they don't take into account the fact that last year alone, Australia provided $160 million in support for peacekeeping efforts established and organised by the United Nations in various hotspots in Africa. And that's not taken into account. Yet peace building and the maintenance of peace is absolutely fundamental to the development of a country and its economy and its sustainability. So I think it's misleading to only look at what strictly goes through your aid program that is defined by guidelines that I think don't recognise the diversity of how development assistance can be provided in various countries. Now, let's not overstate it. I don't know that this will start a global Green Book movement, but perhaps it's not such a bad idea.
We've got time for a few more questions. I saw this lady on the end and then the gentleman at the back.
Thank you very much. A follow-up in one sense to that term. You mentioned economic growth as being an important factor in determining where aid goes. Okay, health is an important aspect of economic growth, but you didn't mention it specifically. I'm wondering in terms of, I guess one might say, multilateral entities such as the Global Fund, such as Gavi vaccination, which has saved squillions of lives internationally, will Australia be looking to continue to support those sorts of organisations and in association with that, is it possible, again thinking in Green Book terms, that the $20 billion of research funding, that's medical research funding, could be construed in part in its overseas contexts and collaborations and so forth?
We continue to commit to multilateral funds where we believe they get the outcomes, they're efficient, they're effective, and we in fact grade them within the department, and Gavi and the Gavi Alliance and Global Fund are all top ranking, as are others like Red Cross. So we continue to provide funding to multilateral organisations that we believe give value for money in that they do achieve outcomes, particularly focused on our region, the Indian Ocean, Asia Pacific. In terms of health, that is one of our fundamental platforms for aid in the Pacific. We're just doing things differently. For example, one thing that Michael Bloomberg came up with through our innovation exchange, which I think is terrific, and just my sort of public-private partnership, Bloomberg Philanthropies put in $80 million and we put in $20 million. I thought that was good. And it's called Data for Health. And we have selected 20 countries that have very rudimentary statistics and data. For example, very little on birth rates and death rates and cause of death. And through the use of the most contemporary and up-to-date technology, we will be carrying out a survey of the necessary health data in these 20 countries so that we can then have the evidence base for our public health policies to be established. Currently, in some countries, we're sort of going in blind. We don't know the major causes of death. We don't know the major causes of infant mortality because it's not recorded. This way, we're setting up the database, the census that is required for the aid dollars in health to be absolutely targeted and customised to that country.
Thank you. The gentleman in the back.
The last bit about the research fund, the medical research fund, that is essentially designed to support the research into health and disease in Australia. But, of course, our researchers and scientists collaborate internationally. So whatever good work we would do here in Australia would obviously, in the usual course, be available worldwide. But under the ODA guidelines that Jenny raised, you can spend money in Australia on health and medical research that benefits a country that receives ODA status, just as we can do agricultural research through the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research in Australia, as long as it is for the benefit of a developing country that is considered ODA-able.
Yes, for me, sir. I guess she kind of asked my question already. The issue with, of course, foreign aid, you know, and I look at countries in Africa where you've mentioned how you give money to the United Nations peace building. But you've also mentioned Joseph Ney talking about soft power. What kind of soft diplomacy is Australia as a country playing in Africa, and especially West Africa, where I think at the end of this month, where Australia is actually cancelling all its like volunteer program, and these are things that have helped organizations in Africa quite significantly, because I just returned back from Ghana, where, you know, people were really appreciative of Australia's efforts in bringing volunteers to sort of build capacity in their institutions, and that is sort of not there anymore. What?
We still have a volunteer program, and that is working in partnership with NGOs and private sector volunteer programs. The Australian government still supports a volunteer program. But our focus has to be on our region. Our focus is primarily on the Pacific, and we don't ask anybody else to take responsibility for the Pacific, but we certainly welcome support. And we support the Pacific, and we expect other developed countries to take primary responsibility for countries with whom they have a deep historical, social, economic connection. And in the case of African nations, that tends to be Europe and the United States. That doesn't mean that Australia doesn't continue to engage globally. We have global interests and we will continue to engage in Africa. Of course, we set up and established and funded one of the Ebola treatment centres in Sierra Leone and had Australian health professionals working over there to ensure that that disease could be contained. We also provide significant funding to multilateral organisations, the United Nations and others, who have significant programs and initiatives throughout Africa. The point I was making about the peacekeeping and peacebuilding initiatives is that $160 million from Australia in 1 year is a significant investment in stability in African nations, enabling them to get on with the business of developing their societies and their communities. But Australia continues to play a role, but our focus will unapologetically be on our region.
I'll take one final question from this lady, if she'll keep it brief.
Venus Kalesi from the Australian Baha'i Community. Thank you for all the support you and your government have offered to the plight of the Baha'is in Iran, particularly in relation to the seven Baha'i leaders who are serving one of the longest sentences given to prisoners conscious in Iran. I'm interested to know about the role of human rights and the place of human rights in Australia's foreign policy, and how you also see to be the most effective means for upholding human rights abroad.
In the case of particular instances of human rights abuses or allegations of human rights abuses, we raise them in our bilateral discussions with other countries. I visited Iran recently, the first foreign minister to do so in about 13 years. But we have an embassy in Tehran. A number of other countries left and don't have embassies. We have maintained an embassy there. And so we have been able to maintain a dialogue with Iran over human rights issues. And during my visit to Iran, I again raised these specific issues with them. We do have human rights dialogues with a number of countries, including China, including Vietnam, at ministerial level. I think our human rights dialogue with China is the only one that China has at ministerial level, and likewise with Vietnam. They are issues that we raise constantly, just as I raise consular cases on a constant basis with a varying degree of success. We likewise raise human rights issues. Australia believes that we should take a position on the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, and so we put forward our name for the 2018 Human Rights Council. And in that way, we can hopefully demonstrate by example and by the submissions that we make to other countries about human rights issues, we'll be able to make a positive difference. So it's an essential part of foreign policy, and as I've said throughout my speech, it reflects who we are as a nation, and hence our influence and our voice internationally is reflected in our commitment to freedoms, rule of law, human rights.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think you've seen in the depth and breadth of Julie Bishop's speech and her answers to our questions today why she's regarded as one of the very best performers in the Abbott government, and indeed why there's so much interest in Julie Bishop's political future as well as the job she's doing now. Would you please join... Huh?
I said, here is my political future.
Here's her future. I can announce she's joining the Lowy Institute. No. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the Foreign Minister. Foreign Minister, you're always welcome to visit us at the Institute. Please, next time, bring the koalas. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you next Monday for our next event, a discussion indeed on some of the issues that Julie mentioned, China's role in global governance, with Dr. Yu Yi. Thank you very much.